Home cooks throughout the American South treasure time-honored recipes for hearty soups and satisfying stews savored year after year. Often passed down through the generations, the dishes detailed in Nancy McDermott's new book, Southern Soups and Stews, are cherished and shared at family gatherings, holiday feasts, and community suppers throughout the seasons. The recipes serve up soups and stews seasoned with history, from Natalie Dupree's Lowcountry okra and shrimp gumbo, to summer squash soup with black pepper and thyme, to collard greens with dumplings, offering us a glimpse of how people framed, cooked, and continue to celebrate life over time. Nancy McDermott is a food writer, cooking teacher, and author of 10 cookbooks, the new one, Southern Soups and Stews, and it's a great pleasure to welcome Nancy McDermott to the roundtable this morning. Nancy, thank you very much for being with us.
Oh, what a pleasure to be here.
Very nice to have you with us. You're a food writer, a cooking teacher. How did you come to write such a book, especially with a focus of Southern soups and stews?
Well, I'm a North Carolina native, born and raised, so I've been eating Brunswick stew and oyster stew and she crab soup and all those good Southern treats all my life. And I've always loved to cook. And getting other people into the kitchen and sharing the pleasure that I find in cooking is kind of what all my food writing has been about. And I've written a lot about Asian food, but I started writing about Southern food when I moved back to North Carolina 15 years ago. And this book is food and stories. I'm always writing about, you know, what kind of, why do people make this and what stories come with it. So there's nothing more storied than soups and stews and getting people around a table.
So it's holiday time. How does this fit into that season?
Well, there's a holiday soup tradition in the South. The biggest one is oyster stew and just things with oysters and coconuts and oranges. Those are three ingredients which, you know, back in the time before interstates and easy travel and refrigeration, those were ingredients that literally weren't available most of the year. And then all of a sudden it's cold enough to, you know, ship coconuts from the Caribbean and oranges that are coming in season in Florida, and oysters from Charleston and Savannah and all the coastal areas were a Christmas time treat. So, I mean, I remember my grandfather making oyster stew on Christmas Eve, and it was butter and onion and milk and fresh oysters. And I didn't like the oysters, but I just loved the flavor of the soup just from the time that I was a child. And what I remember is that he went in the kitchen and sat down at the table and opened the oysters and made this, it's really more of a soup, although it's called oyster stew. And that made an impression on me as, you know, a five-year-old child, however old I would have to be to remember that. It's like, wait a minute, granddaddy doesn't cook. What's going on? So that made it special. The oysters made it special for my parents, and people still serve that on Christmas Eve, even though we can get oysters most of the year, and, you know, a lot of guys are in the kitchen nowadays.
And it doesn't have to be cream-based?
No. This one is, I don't know if it's just North Carolina, but it's kind of a Piedmont thing. It's just dairy milk and a little bit of butter and salt and pepper. And then things vary. I've got also in the book, I've got a New Orleans oyster stew that does have cream, and it has a simple roux that thickens it up. So, I mean, one thing that I found with the book is like, okay, so what is gumbo? I've got a whole chapter. I've got, you know, seven or eight different ones, and somebody says, there's no tomato in gumbo, and then you go over here to a Creole gumbo, and you bet there's tomato there. So instead of being definitive and saying, I figured out what this one dish is, what I always find out is, here's how people make it here, here's how people make it there, and I think the interesting thing is comparing, not saying who's right.
You actually, Nancy, took one of the questions off my list, which is, what is a gumbo? And so there isn't a clear definition.
You're exactly right. I'd say there's two big categories. And, you know, first and foremost, and I think we can thank the late, great chef Paul Prudhomme for kind of bringing that Cajun gumbo with the, you know, the long-cooked, caramelized, rich brown roux and a lot of spicy heat and maybe andouille sausage and tasso ham and seafood, this really rich gumbo over rice that's roux-based, that's spicy, that's a Cajun classic. But there are also Creole gumbos, which, you know, which are more of a New Orleans city-fied version, and they might or might not have a roux. They almost always had lots of seafood and crab and often having tomatoes, which is a no-no in a Cajun gumbo. But then if you go back in my direction towards South Carolina, the gumbos of the Lowcountry don't have roux at all, and they don't have, you know, pork and and andouille sausage and those traditions. And that goes back, and all of these have a strong African heritage to them as far as the type of cooking and what's in it. And the word gumbo in one of the Bantu languages of sub-Saharan Africa was a word for okra. So in those low country gumbos, you're almost always going to have okra and tomatoes, and you're going to have a lot of seafood, and it's going to be quite a different experience than the kind of thing that we get in Cajun country, but they're all gumbos. And then even you get two Cajuns together and somebody's saying, what do you mean? You can't put such and such in such and such. And that's the Italian grandmothers arguing about something. That's part of the pleasure of it, not deciding who's right.
In talking about that low country cuisine, you have a recipe in the book for Natalie Dupree's low country okra and shrimp gumbo.
I wanted to start with that because that's, I think people think Cajun, and that is, you know, it's just as much gumbo. It's those low country people still make it, still love it. It hasn't gotten that, you know, that national thing, but it's got the flair. I mean, that's one thing that I love about writing about Asian food or Southern food. I love the regional stories, and I love how in the South you can go to the low country of the coastal South Carolina and Georgia. You can go up to coastal, up to the Tidewater, the coastal Virginia area, and then Maryland, the Chesapeake Bay, and then out to you know, Louisiana. They've got the city of New Orleans, and then they've got Cajun country, and Florida is just, you know, everywhere you go, there are stories, and there are ways that people do things. And I didn't run out of recipes. I ran out of space. I could have written twice as many recipes and still learn new ones.
There are great varieties, but there's still a commonality when we think of this Southern cuisine.
Absolutely. I mean, I think one thing that makes Southern food so appealing and special is that it's just naturally what we're kind of coming back to paying attention to today. Southern cooking traditionally was seasonal because we're so blessed. We have, you know, a growing season that starts probably, in March and early April. You can start getting that, you know, spinach and lettuces and things into the ground and go all the way till frost. We still haven't had a hard frost, and we've got, you know, greens out there that stay all winter long. We've had a rural footprint. So that keeps things seasonal, it keeps things local and regional, and it has, I think, kept people, you know, sort of cooking. There's a home cooking tradition in the South, particularly for baking, that isn't true all over the country. Because, you know, in the Northeast, people, you know, Italians and French people and German people, you know, people came to cities and they established bakeries and restaurants, and so those sort of more city cuisines thrived. In the South, there was, you know, here was somebody on a farm, and you grew your wheat, and you grew your corn, and you went to the mill, and you made sorghum syrup, and you had chickens. And so even though not everybody was doing it, somebody was living in Atlanta and New Orleans, but there's still that footprint of regional, local, traditional, and a lot of storytelling while people are cooking and eating.
So can a good old-fashioned damn Yankee find collard greens to make a good stew?
Yes, sir, you can. That's, my daddy was a good old-fashioned damn Yankee. My father was an Irish, his parents were Irish immigrants, came through Ellis Island, met in New York City. So he was a first-generation American, and he came down to North Carolina during World War II in the Marines to teach riflery right here in Chapel Hill, and met my mother, whose family had a dairy farm out in the country between Chapel Hill and Hillsborough, and he fell in love with the South, and he spent his whole happy 89 years of life. Most of it was lived in North Carolina very happily. So I think the great thing nowadays is that we can get anything almost anytime. I mean, that's, you know, it's go to your local farmer's market and get what's fresher in season, or go to the supermarket and there, you know, you're going to find collards and kale and chard and all those ingredients. And even if you didn't find collards because you're not in the South, you're still going to find something that's a leafy winter green. And it's not about, you know, complete faithfulness to what I wrote in the recipe. It's, you know, recipes are maps. So I'm telling you, how do you get to Charleston? Well, you take the interstate or you take the country road and you get in there, and this kind of cooking, soups and stews especially, it's very forgiving. It's people are using this ingredient because they had it. If you don't have that, what could you use that would be similar? So if I don't have, you know, green onions, I use shallots. And if I don't have shallots, I leave them out. There's still some, this is very forgiving, user-friendly, makeable, doable food.
One of the things that I notice, and certainly not all the way through or prevalent, but it does make its way through many of the recipes, and Cajun aside, there is spice here, isn't there?
Yes, although I'd say that's something that I really noticed having spent a lot. The other thing I read about is Asian food and Thai food in particular. I was in the Peace Corps in Thailand and came back, and my first probably 15 years of food writing was writing a lot about Asian food. And when I came back, moved back to North Carolina in 1999 and started, you know, thinking about the food of my childhood and the food of my place, it's amazing how outside of New Orleans and Texas, you know, a lot of Southern dishes like Brunswick stew and chicken and dumplings and red beans and rice and she crab soup and chicken bog, we use a lot of salt and pepper, and we use a lot of pork products. That salty, you know, bacon or fatback or ham hocks or something like that was often used in a big pot of water, a couple of ham hocks, get that broth flavorful, and then put in black-eyed peas or field peas or greens. There's a whole lot of using sort of salty preserved pork products for flavor and maybe a little bit of chili. But a lot of the times I think, well, why didn't we use basil? Why wasn't there dill and oregano and all these herbs? They would have grown here. But it's really a cuisine more of plenty and generosity and not so much of nuance. I think, you know, when you look at East Asian cuisine or when you look at Thai or South Asian cuisine, there's all these spices, there's all this mixture. And a lot of Southern cooking is comfort food. I mean, I'd say chicken, my grandmother's chicken and dumplings. She put a chicken in a pot, covered it with water. When it was done, she took it out and put the meat back in. She took some of the broth, mixed it with flour, and rolled out what, you know, she called them dumplings, but they're really noodles, and dropped those back into the boiling pot. And here is a satisfying, delicious, simple dish that'll feed 10 people on one chicken. And, you know, I've made it for people, and I say, well, this is good, but, I mean, could you put in some carrots or celery? It's like, sure, you can put in andouille sausage. You can put in smoked paprika. Make it your own. I'm not saying, here is the Bible, follow my verse. I'm saying, here's this food. It's been around a while. Here's the story behind it. Now, you use this as a jumping-off place and make this and change it, or make something that this reminds you of from your tradition. I just want people to cook.
You mentioned Brunswick stew a moment ago. You have a recipe in here for a Georgia-style Brunswick stew. What makes a Brunswick stew a Brunswick stew?
It's going to be, traditionally it was fall. There'd be game meat, so there'd be maybe some squirrels if you were, you know, people were had gone hunting.
Yep.
But there's always going to be chicken. There's usually going to be stew beef and sometimes other meats. I'm talking about, I'm starting with North Carolina because that's my reference point. But it's two or three kinds of meat and water and a broth made from that. And then vegetables, not the fresh vegetables of the summer. Brunswick stew is a community dish. People made it usually traditionally outside, traditionally often in the old cast iron wash pot over a wood fire. It was often made for a fundraiser for the church to build a new Sunday school building or to get a new a fire truck for the volunteer fire department or uniforms for the baseball team. So you've got that meat broth, and in go corn and butter beans, which are little tiny cousins of lima beans, lots of tomatoes to make it sort of rosy colored and a rich broth, a lot of onions, potatoes, and that's about it. And this was just cooked and cooked until it was a really thick broth. You could almost, a thick stew, almost eat it with a fork. It's very mild in flavor. And it was a fundraiser and a community gathering. And people didn't make it with fresh ears of corn. It would be made in November. So they'd go into the pantry and get those tomatoes that they had canned, you know, in the heat of August and put that in. So it's just this big sort of plain, satisfying dish. Now then you move over to the one I have from Georgia, from my friend Mrs. Virginia Brock, my friend's mama, and this Georgia version is tricked up and fancy, and it's absolutely delicious. It's not wrong, but she uses ground beef and ground turkey. I'm sure she used regular chicken in the olden days, but I think this is kind of she's adapted the recipe over time. It's got barbecue sauce in it, and it's got peas, and it's got this richness and that sweet sour flavor of barbecue sauce, and it's absolutely delicious. But I'd never had that. That wasn't Brunswick stew to me, and of course that's also not a fundraiser. That's one that she and her Georgia ladies came up with to make indoors for parties or for family gatherings. So that's that Georgia style. It's like nobody owns it. Everybody takes it and says, well, this is good, but I think it'd be better with a little bit of X. And then that's their version.
And finally, as we wrap up, and one more Southern to Yankee, Yankee to Southern dictionary reference that I need help on. Hoppin' John, this is something that you can have for good luck on New Year's Day.
You bet. And you know, you don't have to be Southern to get the good luck. Hoppin' John is, so there's all sorts of really, I think, kind of silly stories about there was this guy named John and he only had one leg, or he burned his toe, or whatever. What Jessica Harris, who wrote High on the Hog and is a scholar and a just a brilliant teacher of traditional Southern food and especially African-American culinary history, she notes that the Caribbean pois de pigeon, which is a rice and beans dish all over the Caribbean, pois de pigeon, Hoppin' John. She thinks that comes from a pronunciation of, you know, a French word by somebody who was in South Carolina and said, say what? But what it is field peas. Now, the most common one is black-eyed peas. But one reason that black-eyed peas are the most used for that New Year's Day tradition and for Hoppin' John is that you can get them all over the country. Now, if you're in South Carolina, if you're in the low country, you've got Savannah red peas. You've got Sapelo Island peas. And when we say peas, you might call them beans. You know, think of black-eyed peas. They're a bean. They grow in a pod. But we call them peas. They're field peas. They're a natural protein, and that rice and peas is a natural protein combination with African roots. The tradition is that the peas, I'll say the black-eyed peas, those are the coins that are jingling in your pocket. And the collard greens, or whatever kind of greens, could be turnip greens, mustard greens, spinach, it could be kale, whatever kind of greens you've got cooked down, that's folding money. So on the first day of the year, on New Year's Day, you want to eat some field peas, black-eyed peas, and you want to eat some green. Now, the Hoppin' John is a dish where the field peas, black-eyed peas, are cooked with rice. So Hoppin' John we eat all year, and a lot of people have it on New Year's Day. But the most common thing that I didn't grow up with Hoppin' John. I grew up with black-eyed peas and greens. And if you walk into my Harris Teeter grocery store any time around, like from January 28th on, the first thing you hit is a big display, and it's fresh collard greens, and they're like gigantic fans. I mean, they're like palm, they're like leaves of palm trees, huge, beautiful collards, and sacks of fresh black-eyed peas. But you can use canned, you can use frozen, you can use frozen spinach. Just eat something green and some black-eyed peas on New Year's Day, and the luck is going to come to you.
Well, the name of the book is Southern Soups and Stews, and it is published by Chronicle Books. Nancy McDermott is a food writer and cooking teacher born and raised in North Carolina. Nancy, you're a delight. Thank you very much for being with us, and have a beautiful holiday season.
You too. I hope it's a sweet holiday for everyone there.
Thank you very much. Again, the name of the book, Southern Soups and Stews by Nancy McDermott, published by Chronicle. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.